techno scrum here.
I can send you the copy.
You can send me the copy?
Sure.
Okay. Okay, so shall we take... Yeah, take... Yeah, let's...
Set properly?
Is it set properly?
Yeah, fine.
Okay. We ready to go?
Yeah.
Okay. So let me thank the organizers for inviting me to conclude this workshop on the silences of science, which of course ranged much more widely than that topic, which was already pretty wide to begin with. And what I'd like to do in my remarks is in a way try to organize certain kinds of topics and issues that came up over the course of these days and connect it up with some of the things that I've thought about in the past about silence and science. Because one of the things that I said when I was introducing myself yesterday was that this was a topic that for me in my career was very important at the beginning. And I want to say something about that, because we may be, through your project, experiencing a renaissance in a topic that I don't think has been very popular for a while. But I do think that if you wanted to go back to when this topic was last popular in its kind of global, universalizing sense that we seem to be pursuing it here, it would be the late 1970s, when I was starting my academic career, and when people like Jacques Derrida were coming on the scene, and this business of presence and absence, and all of this stuff became very important, and a lot of issues that had been rumbling for a long time in the phenomenological tradition, through Husserl and people like that, got very much focused on this issue of the problem of silence. And there was also other issues that were coming through in the philosophical tradition that I was trained in, which is analytic philosophy. And I alluded to this in my remarks yesterday. This idea of what does it mean when you're trying to make sense of somebody and they don't say things that you would have expected them to have said? How do you read in the silences? And within analytic philosophy, there is this thing called the principle of charity, where you basically presume they mean pretty much what you would say if you were saying these things. Okay? And so both of these kinds of streams of thinking, which made silence very important for understanding communication, communication breakdown, and all of that, was very actively discussed in the late 1970s, early 1980s, both on the continental and the analytic side. And so there's an interesting question about whatever happened to that conversation. I mean, I think part of it, in a way, has subsisted over the last 25, 30 years. And I think, in a sense, the session on the politics of silencing, I think, is kind of the place where that has kind of continued, right? But that's a very specific way of understanding the issue. And I think the kind of range of issues that we've been sort of looking at over the last 2 days echoes the original global concern. Okay, so the issue about the music... Right, about for example, all of that was back there in the 1970s and 80s. And so there's an interesting question about why did this topic kind of go out of fashion in a way, and why is it now so important, or at least seems to be striking a chord with people now. Now, in terms of the things that I've been listening to over the last couple of days, I would like to make a distinction between two kinds of silences. And let me borrow some of the language from linguistics and talk about a syntactic form of silence and a semantic form of silence. And the clearest way to talk about the syntactic form of silence is kind of the way that Sarah Moore Peach has been talking about it, in terms of the relationship between music and silence, and the kind of thing that, in a way, where you can focus your attention on notation, and how that is sort of formally captured. And in a way, silence is understood, you might say, in a grammatical kind of way, right, as part of the constituents of meaning, right? So you may recall one of the things that she said yesterday in comparing the views of Kant and Derrida, there is an interesting question as to whether, sound is something that is, as it were, imposed on the backdrop of silence, or whether sound and silence are, as it were, co-constitutive, which was what Derrida's view was. The point that Derrida wanted to make about this back in the 70s was that, in a sense, this kind of way of thinking about silence as kind of co-constituent with sound, as part of the grammar by which we communicate, is an artifact of writing, right? That the difference between sound and silence would not be so clear were it not for the notation. And so it was not by accident that Sarah spent so much time, as it were, directing us to the notation, because notation, is not just framing the music, but framing our understanding of what the silence is. Right, and that was Derrida's big point, right? So when he talks about logocentrism, he's basically talking about how the way in which the writing process ends up kind of configuring the way in which we think about language and ultimately thought, and in particular, making this very strong distinction, you might say, between sound and silence, or word and space, or, you know, however you want to parse it, depending on whether you're talking about hearing or seeing, right? And this is writing that's doing this. Okay, and so there's a sense in which this project presupposes, you know, insofar as silence has this kind of autonomous significance almost, it presupposes that kind of viewpoint, that logocentric viewpoint that to a certain extent Derrida was criticizing, or at least trying to deconstruct, you know, in other words, making you more self-conscious about what you're buying into, right? So if you go, for example, back to the days of Socrates, right, grammar had to be invented. Right, and grammar in the sense of actually saying, you know, when people are talking, we can parse what they're speaking in terms of this notation, you know, and these are the words, and this is the order in which they go in, and this is where it stops, and there's a punctuation, and all that kind of stuff. And in Athens, this was this invention or discovery, if you want to call it, was very much attributed to the Sophists, okay, and Protagoras in particular. And Protagoras was basically, this was part of the whole shtick about getting Athenians to be able to speak better, is you have to be more self-conscious about what constitutes your language, and so you have to know what the words are, what the silences are, where you should pause, all the rest of it. Socrates was very much against this. Socrates thought, to put it in a kind of latter-day way, that it was commodification of thinking that was going on here with grammar. Right, and that all of these kinds of distinctions in writing that would then be used as a template against which to measure speech, right, was in a sense, you know, kind of falsifying. Right, in fact, what we should be judging when we're judging a public performance, because what we should be judging is the person. Right, we should judge the whole package, as it were. We shouldn't be just judging the words and whether they're in the right order and they sound right and all the rest of it, but we should be judging what's there in front of you in the public square, because that is what it is to be, you know, a full-bodied, full-blown citizen. And what people like Protagoras was doing with this kind of grammatical understanding of things was abstracting away from it, alienating away from it, and then selling it back to people, of course. Right? Because that was kind of what the Sophists were into. They were trying to make money. And we live with the legacy of this, right? In other words, we presuppose there is a strong distinction between sound and silence. And that is, you might say, the bottom line presupposition that comes with this kind of grammatical, syntactic way of thinking about things. And so we might want to think about what are the costs and the benefits of doing that kind of thing. Okay, but this is what Derrida was on about, you know, whatever, 30, 40 years ago now. And it's a quite profound thing, and it influences the way we frame the topic in a way in which we talked about a lot of the things yesterday, especially with the music, I would say. Now, there's another, the other kind of silence to draw your attention to is the semantic. And what I mean by semantic here, and this gets us closer to the kind of political stuff that was discussed this afternoon, whenever you say something, you're not saying something else. Right? So every sounding is at once a silencing, because you can't say everything at once, right? So there's a sense in which, from a physical standpoint, you've got to be doing some silencing, right? And so then the interesting question is, what is not being said while you're saying this? And that is the semantic use of silence, because what it does is it helps to focus the meaning in a certain way. Okay, and that coincides with the sounding, and so and again, it presupposes this strong distinction between sounding and silencing, and they go together in that sense. And so you might say, from that standpoint, well, if let's say this captures in some way the way in which we speak and think and so forth, then in a sense we're always engaged in some kind of self-censoring, because we're not saying everything that we could be saying about something at the moment. We're only saying a certain thing. And you might say, that's a pretty innocent form of self-censorship, right? It's the only way you can say anything is by silencing everything else. And in things like information theory and all that kind of stuff, there's a lot of discussion about things like this, right? About how many possibilities you have to eradicate in order to actually send a sensible message. But of course, there's a point beyond which the self-censorship becomes pernicious, and we start getting into the political territory of, you know, Foucault and all of his followers and this kind of thing we were hearing about this afternoon. And so, and this also relates to the film stuff, too. And so then the question becomes, okay, when does the self-censorship move from being this fairly necessary kind of approach to communicate at all, where you have to suppress a lot of stuff that you could be saying, to this other thing, right, where in a sense, you know, by speaking, you're actively self-distorting, essentially. right? Even if you're given a voice, you're self-distorting. And so that's an interesting kind of question, because there's a sense in which the processes involved, it's the same process, but there's a point at which there's a normative judgment that's made about when the self-censorship becomes bad, right? And how that works. But one of the things about this kind of, by thinking about silence in this kind of semantic way, is that what it draws attention to is the fact that that in a sense, there are always options as to what to say in a given situation, and that some things are said and some aren't, and it makes you kind of then forces you to compare, right? The presence with the absence, okay? And people may draw different kinds of conclusions from that. Now, when one of the ways in which I got interested in silence as a student in the philosophy of science was through reading the book by Paul Feyerabend, who was a very kind of hot figure when I was a student. I don't know if people read him anymore, but it was hot when I was a student. Against Method has a chapter where he talks about a very peculiar kind of situation, and he uses it to illustrate incommensurability between two different ways of thinking. In this case, our own way of thinking and the Homeric Greeks. This is where I came up with this idea of the inscrutability of silence. And it's a kind of it's an issue about interpretation, but I think it has a much larger kind of political consequences as well. So what do you find? In the Homeric epics, you find a lot of words and references to parts of the human body, but you don't find any word or discussion of the body as a whole. Okay? And so why is there this absence? You might say, well, come on, it's pretty obvious that if this guy's talking about arms and legs and hands and things like this, you know, and heads and all that, because, you know, it's war after all, things are being chopped off, you know, things like that. That in fact, he's presupposing the existence of a sort of integral body of which these things are part, right? And that this body has some kind of semantic significance in the Homeric culture. But this is not so obvious, okay? And in fact, Feyerabend's point is that, in fact, that... That it took quite a metaphysical sea change over the course of the history of ancient Greece for people to actually come up with that kind of an assumption that we just blithely make and then impute to those guys in the past. Now, if you follow this kind of analytic philosophy principle of the principle of charity, right, whenever you have absences of this kind, when you're trying to make sense of past texts, you read them in what you regard as a charitable way, namely they're just like us in the way they think. Now, of course, if you take, you know, if you apply this principle generally, and by the way, this is the principle on the back of which you can then talk about the general rationality of people, so that, as it were, irrationality becomes an exception. So analytic philosophers think they're doing humanity a favor by interpreting things this way, right? Because by making more of humanity think like us in terms of assumptions, right, then we have greater grounds for calling them rational. Because the only grounds that we ever have for calling anyone rational, and even analytic philosophers know this, is extensions of ourselves. Okay? And so you imagine that there isn't really that much difference between them. People just differ on the margins. They differ because they have different particular kinds of experiences, but in terms of this general mental framework and the way people think and things like that, generally the same. So if they don't talk about stuff that you take for granted, they're probably taking for granted too. Okay? Now, I know, to this crowd, this must sound like total bonkers, but trust me, analytic philosophers take this stuff seriously. Okay? But of course, one of the consequences of this is that it becomes very difficult then, you know, in a sense, you're sort of always already co-opted, right? If you're the other being interpreted, right, you're always already being co-opted. So whatever you don't say is presumed to agree with me. So you're always kind of forced in the back foot where you have to constantly be articulating your differences if you're going to have any sense of autonomy at all. Okay? So that's kind of the dark side of this sort of position of the principle of charity. And, you know, you really need to have something like a kind of Foucauldian mindset to be able to perceive that, because the analytic philosophers don't really pick up on that point. Okay? They see it as a way of establishing universal rationality. They don't see it as a way of just accommodating and co-opting everyone and making it difficult to express any kind of substantial differences. Okay? So that's kind of an important thing. And I do think that some of the political stuff that we looked at really addressed that point. But then this question arises. I think what the analytic philosophers are describing is, in fact, something that happens, you know, at a real level. You know, and you might say imperialist projects and things of this kind do this all the time, right? Everybody all over the world are already reasonable. We just have to work out the differences on the margins. And so in that case, then, how does one then assert the relevant kinds of differences that in turn can lead to some kind of productive outcome, right? So I take the point that was being raised here at the end about the need for dialectic and the need for communication and so forth, but the initial terms of the engagement aren't very promising. Okay, because you have one side that is over-accommodating and taking you already in, assuming you already agree, right? So you don't have to say what you're saying, because I already know what you think, right? And then in order for you to assert your difference, you got to sound like a maniac, which I think is one of the points you were making, right? Where, you know, all this clamoring and so forth of feminists and things like this. And so there's a real problem here that is associated with what analytic philosophers would regard as a very benign principle of universal rationality, okay? Now, this has all kinds of other sorts of issues. I mean, if you look at the history of analytic philosophy, and then you, I believe, brought up Wittgenstein, was it? Or was it the... it was Mark. Or was it you? It was one of you two. One of you two theological types. I mean, you know, especially the end of the Tractatus. Yeah, the end of the Tractatus, you know, that of which we cannot speak, of that we must remain silent. What? It was who? It was... Well, Mark, okay. Well, the point is somebody said it, okay? This is not a hallucination on my part. Okay. Now the interesting thing about this kind of notion, right, that you get in Wittgenstein is the idea that if there are these things that are, let's say, not said, you know, like what we were talking about in terms of implicit assumptions that people are making when they speak, that in some sense they could be said, right? If they are there, they can be said. And so in the sense, silence becomes a technical problem, right? Silence becomes a technical problem where you're excavating, you're explicating, you're kind of laying out all the stuff, and if there is something there, if there is some content there that's missing, we can identify it and put it as a proposition. Now, if we can't do that, then there's nothing there. Okay? And that's part of, and in a sense, that becomes in the project of analytic philosophy, you might say. And one of the things that you find very often that analytic philosophers say, especially in their theories of communication, this is where principles of parsimony and economy play a kind of pernicious role, right? Why are things just not said openly? Well, because they're taken for granted. They're already known. You don't have to waste the time to unload those propositions, but we can unload them if we wanted to because we already know what they are. There's no real difference out there, right? And so the role of economy and parsimony that supposedly makes communication more fluid and allows us not to lay out everything explicitly, right, can be a suppressive move. Okay, but again, that is part of the way in which analytic philosophers parse this issue of silence. Now, let me move a little bit more into the theological, since we start, if God gets mentioned, I'm there. So then there is this issue, one way of glossing silence, and this comes, you know, Wittgenstein is tapping into this, but this predates it, is this business of what is unknowable is unspeakable, okay? And the apophatic theology, all this kind of stuff, where you only can know God negatively and so forth. And there's a very interesting kind of, one of the things that people often don't realize about the history of the field called epistemology is that when it was introduced into English in the mid-19th century by a Scottish guy, James Ferrier, in the Institutes of Metaphysics, that's where the term epistemology first appears in the mid-19th century, he talks about it as kind of epistemology is a kind of the alleviation of ignorance, where the idea is, again, in a kind of German idealist way, everything is knowable. There's just certain things we don't know. And so we can find out about them. But what there isn't, what doesn't exist, is the unknowable. Okay? There's the unknown, but not the unknowable. Because if the unknown was unknowable, how would we know it was unknown? Okay? And I think that's a very kind of, you know, so in other words, there, you know, there's a sense in which with this kind of viewpoint from which epistemology came, there was this idea that in principle you could articulate everything. Right, and that in a sense that would be the quest of the search for knowledge. And I think, you know, if you think about how science, especially realist forms of science, were pursued in the late 19th and 20th century, you can see this kind of image very strongly there. Right, that the unknowable is in a way not something that one can talk about or put into a system or even have as a boundary condition. Because you're already defeating the concept by articulating it. Okay? And they were using this, by the way, people like Ferrier and some of the idealist people he was inspired by, like Fichte and Schelling and Hegel and guys like that, they used this argument initially as an argument against Kant's idea of noumenon, right? The things in themselves, right? The things as they are in themselves, independent of our knowledge of them, right? And this was kind of a metaphysical way of, in a way, talking about God, right? And the point was that in some sense we could not occupy that standpoint from which to know what these things are intrinsically, right? And of course, with these views of theology that postulate a very absolute difference between God and humans, right, there is going to be this kind of barrier there, right? And as the point you were making yesterday was, in Christianity, there's a kind of a consolation prize almost for our ultimate ignorance of God through Jesus Christ, right? Because in a sense, the aspects of God that filter through Jesus, we can know because Jesus is human too. But that doesn't cover everything about God. There's all this other stuff we can't know. And so then the question comes, can we make up the difference? And part of what the profane theology of science, natural theology, for example, was that you can make up the difference, especially through physics. And that was Newton's project. But, you know, the point is that theologians, because of the various issues involved with science and religion that you were talking about yesterday, theologians have tended to shy away from endorsing that kind of conclusion. Okay? But I do think that there is a sense in which this issue where silence comes in as a kind of an ultimate trump card that stops the conversation about something, right? There are just some things that we're never going to make any headway on in terms of our understanding, right? I mean, that's a theological issue, it seems to me. And then the question is, to what extent do we need to buy into that, okay? And I think you were quite right. You know, people can interpret that kind of silence, that kind of unknowability, in two ways, right? One can see it as kind of obstructionist, perhaps, right? But on the other hand, one can see it as this moment where you sort of just open yourself to something that you cannot fully understand, right? And you just sort of, there is that, just that moment. And Wittgenstein had a lot of that kind of sentiment in him. Now, one of the things that I was struck by, and this goes back to your early remarks, where you were talking about Francis Bacon's problems with loquacity. and this is a quite important point about, because here's a more, you might say, positive epistemological role of silence. Because, you know, with the unknowability and all this kind of stuff I've just been talking about, this seems to kind of put a limit on what knowledge can accomplish. But when you look at the early Royal Society, and certainly this is true with Francis Bacon and with the founders of the Royal Society, who are inspired by Bacon, is they believe that you can't make much progress in knowledge unless you've got ways of resolving dispute. So, you know, with all due respect to your wonder, you know, you want dialectic, okay? Well, Francis Bacon was trying to shut down dialectic, okay? And so how would you do it? Well, you would do it, you know, through the virtual witnessing, or the witnessing, if you're there, you know, of some perspicuously made experiment, right? So the silence would come from your being able to see the result, and no matter how people were processing it linguistically, they could all agree, yeah, it works, right? That was kind of what the model was. And that's why it was very important that you could trust the people who made the experiments and so forth. And so there's a whole ethic behind this. And this is not, and so it's not by accident these people all knew each other. They were part of a men's club and all this kind of stuff. Right? But the point is, at the end of the day, right, that kind of common agreement over something that one could see with one's own eyes or could be represented in a way that people who weren't there could believe what was being represented, that was meant to end discussion. And that silence would then say, we've established something. We've got a fact. Right? That's why, you know, the Royal Society, never take anything on words. Right? You want to see it. And the seeing operates as a silencing mechanism. And so in this famous book that many of you know about, right, Leviathan and the Air Pump, right, the punchline is Thomas Hobbes, the great philosopher and former secretary to Francis Bacon, he gets kicked out, right, because of the Royal Society, because he won't stop talking. He disputes all the evidence. He disputes all the experiments. He says, but on the other hand, you know, just like what you'd like them to do, right? You'd be Hobbes' advocate. I mean, and it'd kick you out too. But the point is that kind of silencing gets seen as a very kind of proper epistemological way of ending disputes and begins this century-long distinction between science and philosophy, right? Where the philosophers chatter, you know, endlessly and can dispute anything under the sun, whereas the scientists move on. They put a line under something, we've established this, we move on, establish the next thing, move on. Okay? And so the discipline of science, the way you train to be able to do experiments, be able to see experiments properly, all that kind of stuff is very important in maintaining that trajectory, which is very strong today. And a big component of that, right? So it's not only the silence that comes from observing something to be the case, and everybody kind of agreeing they see the same thing, but it also comes from the nature of the training, because it's not just, you know, obviously training of the eyes, but training being able to do an experiment. So part of what you can do if you have been trained to do experiments is you can imagine what it was like to have done that experiment. You can see this experiment was done properly, and that the result is not just a gimmick or a magic trick or something like that. Right, so you have to and all this is associated with tacit knowledge. It's not associated with knowledge that you kind of discursively provide to people by making arguments with them and convincing them things. You just tell them this is how you do it, and if you don't want to do it this way, you're not doing science. Okay, and this is why philosophers often regard science very sort of crass enterprise from an intellectual standpoint, because so much of the acculturation process of science is in a certain way anti-intellectual. Right, it's very much a crap thing. Okay. And Thomas Kuhn made a big deal about this, okay? I mean, I think that's a very important point. That for somebody like Thomas Kuhn, who's most influential of the theorists of science in the second half of the 20th century, right, the part of the sociology that really mattered to him was that, okay? And so when Thomas Kuhn talks about the incommensurability of worldviews and paradigms and things like that, he's primarily talking about people seeing the world in different ways. Not that they're talking about it in different ways, because that might suggest that you could make some translations and things, but seeing it in different ways, because they're sort of trained in a certain manner, and they see it one way and not another way. And Kuhn's point was that the only time that, what this does is it means that there's an enormous amount of silence, you might say, on a regular basis in normal science about fundamentals. As long as the experiments work, as long as we continue doing our thing and we get results that we think are reasonable results, we continue doing it, and we don't have an incentive as scientists to question fundamentals, and which would then lead us to get very discursive about what things mean. But of course, you know, the point is that paradigms don't solve all their problems, they accumulate anomalies over time, and then you have to start talking. Right? And that's when you get the crisis. Right, the crisis in science comes when you're forced to talk about the underlying principles behind practices that you've all been doing the same way pretty much for the last how many years. But all of a sudden they're not working. The experiments don't quite come out as you expect. And so now you have to start thinking, okay, what's going on here? And then you start to realize, as people argue about these things, that people have managed over the decades thought about the science in somewhat different ways. And they want to push it in different directions. And you see, this is then where you get the crisis that leads to a scientific revolution, where you're forced to start to speak about things which up to this point, you know, there had been closed down for discussion. Because there was a common agreement on the day-to-day practices. And the kind of discussions that you were having, let's say, in the lab, or even publishing in the scientific articles, were not intellectually that demanding when it got right down to it. It didn't force you to question fundamental assumptions. It forced you to mobilize technical terms in artful ways, but it didn't actually get you into the sort of reflexive thinking about what does this mean, which is the stuff that then leads you into a scientific revolution. So there's this interesting issue about the dialectic of silence and sound within science, okay? To be honest with you, this is the kind of thing, even though I think this is something that's pretty obvious for people who do any kind of science studies, what I'm saying, nevertheless, one of the things that would be interesting to do would be to turn it into a museum exhibition. Okay? In other words, have it something that can be publicly displayed. How do you publicly display this process? Okay? And get people to kind of see how it's possible for people who've been trained in common ways and have done experiments in the same way, nevertheless, under certain kinds of anomalous or ambiguous conditions, might start to interpret what's going on quite radically, which then would force them to have to talk about more fundamental issues. Okay? And see, that I think would be a kind of interesting challenge to come from this. I'm going to just say one more thing and then stop. One of the things that also, the issue about silence that I was very struck by when Ken Arnold from here, this business about, he was interpreting silence kind of broadly and in a way kind of as absence, the idea that you don't want the art or the artifacts to be overexposed, right? The value-enhancing qualities of silence, you might say. The value-enhancing qualities of absence. And one of the things that this put me in the, you know, I mean, I think one of the things to go to your thing this morning about the censors in the United States with the films, I think one of the things that they may have thought was that people would be very impressed by these films and would start getting all kinds of ideas. But perhaps what they didn't realize would be there would be so many of them being shown so often, over and over again, repeats, DVDs, all the rest of it, that the kind of impact they would have through overexposure would not be that strong. And there would be countervailing films as well at the same time. It wouldn't just be that one horror film that everybody's exposed to, but they'd be exposed to a wide range of things. And that, in a sense, would kind of, you know, that kind of pervasiveness, that frequency, that overexposure, overvoicing, if you will, ends up devaluing the effect. So it's not such a scary thing. Okay? And one might argue that's, in fact, how this issue gets resolved psychologically. Right? And in a sense, these guys in the early days thought maybe in a much more restricted video environment than what we ended up having. You see? And so then if you think about what Arnold was saying about the museum exhibits, right? You don't want to have all these things there all the time. You know, the Rosetta Stone is overexposed, right? People don't take it seriously anymore or something. And so the idea is put it away for 20 years, you know? I mean, if you recall Walter Benjamin's notion of aura, right? Aura of the artwork, right? This is kind of, in a way, we're heading into that territory there, right? Where the scarcity, the rarity of the thing, the uniqueness of the thing gives it a kind of value, right? There is only that thing, and if it's not there, nothing's there. Right? It's not that you have this kind of endless repetition, reproduction, right? And Benjamin thought that photographing and films and all these things basically eliminated aura. Right? And so there's a sense in which silence and rarity can actually be a kind of value-enhancing thing in this respect. Okay? So I thought that kind of ends up, you know, hooking up with the exhibition stuff and also with the film stuff as well. So I'll stop here. I just, you know, sort of just wanted to get this down, and I hope it's of some use to you and the audience.
Great, yeah, that was fantastic, Steve. So I guess in that last point, noise is silence. Mm-hmm. We've come the full circle. Yeah, sure.
Charity.
Yeah.
I think it actually, the phenomena is very much related to what someone said in the very beginning about how people listen to the extent that it reinforces their own belief systems.
Yeah.
So you can call it charity, but in a sense, it's actually far more, I don't want to say devious, but.
Oh, it is, but yeah.
It is, but devious.
Pernicious, I think, is more the word, because people don't usually realize that's what they're doing.
Yeah. So charity is, it struck me as kind of the ante of what really the process is.
Yeah.
Or can be used for. Not always, but anyway.
Well, this concept with, I don't know if you're familiar with Quine, but you know, he has this kind of like mock anthropological thing. This is, it comes from his, yeah, imaginary anthropology. This is where this idea comes from.
That's a good point.
Any other comments, either questions to Steve or challenges in the way that he's summarised this, or just other sort of summing up comments you might have?
Just one thing about it. So I was also very, very struck by this principle of charity. And I was just trying to figure out in my head what would be my past if I were kind of an analytic philosopher. I was trying to dig my heels in. It's a question of, you know, well, what is this thing that we charitably attribute? And mm-hmm. I'm just trying to figure out if one could at all plausibly mount a case for a very, very slimmed down, you know, the last thing we would grasp onto, like an agreement with the processes of deductive and
well, that's how you begin, right?
Yeah.
In a sense, that's how you begin, and in a sense, one of the, by assuming that, then you then put yourself in the position of the other person, because if you imagine that there's a certain range of universal thought, that we all have these deductive powers that under, you know, charitable conditions work fine, that then the stuff that's missing from arguments and claims right, are things that we should be able to fill in, because had we left them out, you know, we would have meant this. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's kind of, I mean, so that's, and look, I don't think philosophers make this argument with a straight face, right? I mean they're not trying to be cute or, you know, trying to be hegemonic or anything. It's just, in effect, hegemonic, but it's not, you know, by intent. I mean, I think that the thing they would say is, if you operate with the, because sometimes in this context, when, you know, you bring up this Paul Ricoeur thing, hermeneutics of suspicion, right, which takes kind of just about the opposite position on this, and you know, if you start saying, well, you know, if they're not telling me X, then they don't mean it, that they mean something quite different, you know, and then it becomes impossible to actually have any sustained interaction with people. Right, you have to be very strategic in terms of the, you know, so it's not like people are always, you know, it's not like you always get people right by believing in the principle of charity, but what you're presupposing is that what you don't understand about them is fairly localized, right? It isn't this business that they don't, you know, that they really mean something radically different from you, and they're just talking this way almost as a way of systematically deceiving you. Yeah.
Brian.
Yeah, sorry. Can you just maybe tease out the relevance of purpose here? Mm. Well, especially about what is missing, what can be said, what counts as charity, and when does that go too far? I mean, it strikes me, I mean, this must depend on whether people have a shared sense of the purpose of their communications or their interactions.
No, you see, you're...
a story of that to tell alongside, which is, I guess, is a story of democracy.
Yeah, yeah, see, you're absolutely right. And I think one of the big problems with the way in which the analytic philosophers tend to, the paradigm cases they work from, right, because it's always a kind of an imaginary case, it's one where you're actually trying to, you're basically trying to do field linguistics on the spot, right? So you're trying to make sense of what people mean by what they say independently of particular tasks they're engaged in. Okay, so in a sense, they abstract the purpose question, but you're absolutely right. You know, knowing the purpose makes all the difference in the world. But no, it tends to be in a much more neutral, you know, as it were, task neutral way of putting it. But even if there were a purpose, right? How would that in some way undercut the point about if you buy the principle of charity? Why would the principle of charity be harder to figure out?
I'm not sure. It just seems like the purpose is probably not. There are stages where purpose is more or less, in terms of politics as a whole, questions about where science
sure.
is placed, has more or less a sense of what is this knowledge for.
Well, I'll tell you if you want to talk about the politics of the principle of charity, it goes to a point that I thought he was making there, but I wasn't quite so sure, but one of the points that this gentleman who's absent now was making was this business about the fluency and articulateness stuff. Right, so in other words, the principle of charity presupposes that most of what you need to know to figure out what other people are saying is pretty much there on the surface already. Right, so people are in a sense representing themselves well from a verbal standpoint. And so the stuff that isn't being said that might cause you some need to read into the situation is relatively minor. Right, so that presupposes a certain degree of fluency. Right, because if you got people who in a way, their primary mode of expression is not in this kind of interactive discourse at great lengths, et cetera, then most of the content of what they're up to might not be conveyed in the language at all. Right? In which case, the principle of charity has a hard time getting off the ground that way. So it does presuppose a certain fluency, I think. Which may be in certain cultures, for example, right, could be quite, you know, pernicious. Yeah.
Brian, are you...
Well, I'm hesitating because I feel a little bit out of my depth. But is it not just because you're reducing it also to a purely linguistic problem?
Yeah.
And the point of purpose is actually you talked about the bias on the airport. You're doing things with things, with people. So it's more than just a...
No, that's right.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why I say the principle of charity gets off the ground if you have a very artificial example. Where what you're trying to do is field linguistics, where you're trying to figure out what people mean when they're talking about things, and you're like an anthropologist stumbling in some tribe, and you're kind of asking questions.
You think you'd be an anthropologist like that, wouldn't you?
Because you're not a real anthropologist. No. In fact, you're more like a parachuted anthropologist, not one who actually spends a lot of time living in the place. No, because otherwise you would have started to pick up the context in which people you talk about certain things and so forth. Yeah, no, I mean, In Quine's book, Word and Object, where this ultimately comes from, which is a book now that's been around out for over 50 years, the idea, he's mostly concerned about how do you tell whether they mean X rather than something quite close to X that's really Y. That's kind of what he's mostly concerned about in the principle of charity thing. And he thinks you can kind of bootstrap yourself to a level where you can make those kinds of distinctions. But there's not really a lot of discussion about the more sophisticated kinds of judgments one might make about what people are up to, like why do they do this kind of questions.
And also knowing just enough to get by.
Right.
Or just enough to for everything to fall apart.
Yeah, that's right. No, right, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, there were two questions here.
Can I comment on in terms of this idea of overexposure in movies and media?
Yeah.
In a sense, you're sort of partially right based on the history of media effects research. So that when they were first doing this censorship back in the teens, it was what we would call a strong media effects model because propaganda out of World War I convinced everybody, wow, you can have such an amazing impact through a poster or whatever it was. So there was a sense that an individual movie could be harmful to everybody. And then once you get to the 60s, that weakens significantly. You know, weak media for the individual movies don't mean anything, and that's when the censorship sort of goes away. But censorship and calls for censorship are still around. Yeah. I think of the 80s with Mary Whitehead and then the video nasties. In that case, the media effects research moves to, we're not worried about an individual horror movie, but because there's overexposure, because there's so many horror movies out there that kids are taking it in from everywhere. Mm. So an individual movie won't do anything, but it's the horror movie, it's the death metal, plus the video games, that's what you're getting into now. So yeah, I think you're right in a certain sense, but I think the notion of what needs to be said.
Yeah, there's a kind of a larger cultural issue here that this is playing into. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, Jane.
I was going to try and bring back in some points that were made quite early on. Felicity mentioned in her introduction scientists who have found themselves in quite hot water because they have broken the silence. And we've heard about situations that arise because silences were observed in a kind of neglectful way rather than addressing a problem. And Mark Wheatley spoke yesterday about bad silence. And seems to me that the moral dimension has rather dropped out of the discussion here, and that a lot of perhaps where we were almost going this afternoon was to a place where this meaning that we're giving to science does have a clear moral value and does actually make a difference. So. When we talk about communication around science, we are concerned with the political. I mean, possibly too often, actually, at the moment. But I think if we're going to consider the sciences also, we shouldn't forget that they have political consequences. I mean, somebody said power once, I think. And then,
oh, she said it many times, and you did too. Both of you guys said it many times.
So I would just like to remember those aspects of silence, particularly with regard to what happens next.
Well, it's true. It also came up with the theological stuff too, right? I mean, actually, this is one of the things that Mark Oatley brought up about the bad silences when the church doesn't speak out on various abuses and things like that.
Well, this is what worries me, that we're in a meeting where the most political institution has been the church.
Well, it's not the first time that's happened. Church is actually has good form on this.
Any other comments?
I was wondering, you organizers, in terms of how you will be taking this forward, you know, get some sense of the framing.
So this is a good plan, and James' call there to be more political is a good point at which to consider what happens next. So. The next stage is another workshop, this time just a day long, I think, and that one homing in on the science. So this has been very much I referred to it yesterday, I think it's extreme interdisciplinarity. That's what we've been engaged in the last 2 days, and I hope that's felt a sort of creative and generative interdisciplinarity rather than pure chaos. But I think the next workshop will be much more conventional, probably, much more focused on the science, and that's where I hope we'll be beginning to tease out these sort of political and power dimensions about how science is configured within science. And we had been planning to hold that in mid-November. I now discover it's almost impossible to get rooms in the middle of term time. So we might have to hold that, well, one possibility would be like the week before Christmas. So can I just see, is that a hideous time to have a meeting? Because you've got all that horrible Christmas shopping to do and it's dark. And is that just too dreadful to consider, or would it not? I mean, whether or not you're able to come, you know, just in principle, do you think a mid-December meeting is okay?
Might have been a nice relief.
Yeah.
I guess in some ways it depends on how you define the week before.
Yeah, well, I think literally 7 days before, probably. Something like the 18th or 19th. Okay, well, I'll take that as it wouldn't be too appalling. We're lucky at that.
Use the principle of the chair.
Exactly. There you go. There's a take-home lesson.
We're fortunate at that workshop. The one thing we have sorted is our keynote speaker, so the precise date will depend on him a bit, but Brian Rappert will be giving a keynote at that session. And I think we'll proceed by putting out an open call for papers and seeing what comes in. And then there'll be a third workshop after that, aimed more at an audience of scientists and engagement practitioners, policy practitioners. I've got no idea how we're going to do that one. It's going to need to be a lot more grounded than this one to be tolerated by that audience. And we're also going to be working on some sort of experimental audio production, so a podcast, a silent podcast of some sort. And again, I'm not so sure how we're going to manage that. So, and then there's the question of publications, I'm hoping that will sort of grow out of the next workshop, because that the publication will have to be focused around science more than this session has been. So we'll be back in touch with you all about all these things. I'll also email you expenses forms so that we can cover that part of things. What just remains to say, I think, thank you all very much for coming. I've certainly found it very stimulating couple of days, and really that was our main aim, was to stimulate, I think. I'd like to thank all the speakers for their insightful talks, and the chairs for chairing them, and all the participants for coming along and your very useful contributions. I hope you've enjoyed it.
Thank you. Okay.
See you all
again
soon.
Should we turn in our badges? No, because sometimes you recycle them, you know? Recycle these things.
I don't think we'll bother.
Oh, we've got to turn this off. This is Brian's. Yeah. How does this go? Stop. That sounds good. So,